morning.
Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Steele, good morning. Gregory Varela for Appellee PricewaterhouseCoopers. I rise merely to introduce my colleague who, by previous order of Justice Holland, has been admitted pro hoc in this court and who will, with the court's permission, present the argument on behalf of Pricewaterhouse, Mr. Martin Perschetz of the New York Bar. Also with him this morning is Ms. Goldenstein, also of the New York Bar, and my colleague, Ms. Lisa Swally.
Good morning. Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
You ready?
Yes, I am.
Good morning, Justice Berger, Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs. My name is Kevin Gibson. I'm Supreme Court ID number 2025. I'm here for the appellants. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time, if I can, for rebuttal. We are here today on a motion for summary judgment that was granted by the lower court. It actually was a 12B6 motion that was converted to a summary judgment motion, so we don't even have an answer filed in this complaint. The particular issue being presented to this court today is what, if anything, my clients were on inquiry notice of to commence a statute of limitations. In 1996 through 1999, there was a company in Troy, Michigan called Lazon. It was actively involved in acquiring companies that were engaged in a data capture business. The data capture business would be a company would go to a doctor's office, let's say, and scan all the medical records, put it on a CD, and you'd have a nice repository of concise information. So Lazon wanted to get in that business. It acquired some 76 companies in that time frame. One of those companies was DIT, a client owned by my clients, the appellants in this case. In early July of 1998, my clients were approached by management at Lazon and said, would you like to think about being acquired? My clients became interested. They met with the CEO, a guy by the name of Gary Monroe, about 15 days later. The acquisition discussion became a little bit more intense. A letter of intent was issued, and then due diligence was commenced in August of 1998. Representatives of Pricewaterhouse actually came to my client's facilities, went through our books and records, and he wasn't a CPA. We found that out through discovery. He was an accountant, and he had conversations with my clients, and my clients asked, hey, we've been relying on a publicly filed audit statements. Are they good? And he represented that if they were done by Pricewaterhouse, they could be relied on. After the due diligence period, a formal agreement was entered into, and my clients agreed to be acquired for $18 million. In addition to the cash of the $18 million acquisition price, there was an incentive program built into the agreement of sale whereby after my client was acquired and they were going to become a division, if they continued to hit certain earning levels, that my clients would get more purchase price. This is called the so-called earnouts that you see in our briefs. At closing, Mr. Monroe asked my client to take $500,000 of income that it had earned before closing and move it to the post-closing acquisition books. My clients didn't think much of it at the time, but they did this, and the testimony below in the depositions is that they didn't know why they were being asked to do this, but they thought maybe Mr. Monroe was going to try to look good to the rest of the board of directors by showing, hey, I just got us a new company here. And right off the beginning, it's making substantial money. So they made that intro. Then 40 days later, the infamous Bassman email arrives on my client's comptroller's computer screen. It's an email dated January the 6th from Robert Bassman. Bassman was an assistant comptroller, and I think it's important to note that the trial court, Judge Cooch, in his opinion, refers to Bassman as the CFO. He was not the CFO. He was an assistant comptroller. He wasn't even the comptroller. But in this infamous email, I'm sure Your Honor has seen it, it's an interesting email to say the least, it says, my clients had actually gotten a loan discount when they were acquired. They owed a bank $1,800,000, and they took some of the money they got from Lazon when they were bought and achieved a discount of $800,000 forgiveness of debt. So this email arrives, and it says, with respect to that $800,000 forgiveness of debt, I, Mr. Bassman, the assistant comptroller, would like to deal with this from an aggressive accounting standpoint. I'd like you to book $400,000 of it as revenue and save the rest for a rainy day. Well, my clients have testified below that when they saw that email, they certainly became concerned. Not so much for what they were being asked to do, because my clients testified, and we actually supplied the trial court with an expert witness affidavit, that you can certainly take forgiveness of debt under GAAP and treat it as a reduction of purchase price if you treat it as goodwill. So from an accounting point of view, it wasn't what they were being asked to do that troubled them, but it was the language that, I don't care how you do this, just make sure you hide it from the auditors, that certainly, and I will say, probably raised a red flag. And we'll talk about red flags as we go along. They immediately, upon getting that email, the comptroller and the chairman, Mr. Coleman, Mr. Light, got on the phone, called Gary Monroe, the CEO of Laison, and said, what is this? What are you asking us to do? Hide things from the auditor. Monroe seemed to profess a lot of surprise. He said, I'll investigate this. I'll get back to you. Next day, he called my clients and said, I've talked to Bassman. He's going to work this out with Price Waterhouse. Go ahead and make the entry as we've asked you to do. The clients did that. Again, they don't know, and I tried to stress this to the trial court. They are just a small cog in this big wheel of Laison. Laison's a $500 million a year company. My client doesn't have books and records of access to their books and records. All they have access is to their own books and records, which they send along to Laison. So they didn't think anything they were being asked to do was going to be material to the balance of the statement of Laison, and they didn't know if it even would get reversed by the time it got to corporate. But they made the entry. Then, after doing that, Laison asked my clients to go down to Tijuana, Mexico, and look at managing another company that they had purchased. It's about 6 months, I believe, after the infamous Bassman email. So before they wanted to decide whether they were going to manage this company, they wanted to see whether the company was profitable or not. So Leiden went down to Mexico and looked at this company's books and records, and he started seeing some entries that didn't make sense to him. They were booking wages that were non-existent. Another nagging doubt started to raise my client's consciousness. And this is the argument I made to Judge Cooch is, you take these little things as little incidents, and they trouble you. And then another thing comes along and troubles you. So after the trip to Tijuana, my clients read in the newspapers that Laison had just retained a new outside board director by the name of Brooks. So in June of 2000, at great considerable expense, my clients chartered a Learjet.
Did your clients, or does the record show whether your clients looked at the financial statements, certified financial statements that came out for the period that they were asked to shift earnings and losses to see whether or not there had been a proper treatment of those items?
That has not been explored in discovery. Those questions have not been asked that I'm aware of in the record below.
It's not in the record.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. So they flew to Troy, Michigan, and knocked on the door of this outside director and said, hey, you know, we got this post-income thing, moving the income after closing. We got this Bassman email. Now this thing in Tijuana. Something's not right. Could you please look into this for us? And Mr. Brooks said, I will. And he did not. And I'll use a word, Your Honor, because Justice Jacobs knows very well. They were stonewalled. So then, after 3 months of hearing nothing, they go to the chairman of the board of Laison, and they lay out chapter and verse the concerns that they think that they have regarding the accounting practices of this company. Unbeknownst to them, Mr. Yanover, his name is Robert Yanover, this is the chairman of the board, he creates an internal investigation. He hires a reputable law firm out there in Detroit. The law firm initially retains Price Waterhouse to start looking at the books and records of Laison, and after realizing that's probably putting the fox in the hen house, decided to not retain them. They fired Price Waterhouse from that engagement, and they retained another accounting firm, and then went on an 8-month investigation into the accounting practices of Lazon. This internal board, this internal investigation took 8 months with total access to all Lazon's books and records. And after 8 months, in March of 2001, a filing was made with the SEC. In the interim, by the way, management had been fired at Lazon. Mr. Monroe was gone. The CFO was gone. I think it was an 8-K that was filed in March of 2001 that said, after an internal investigation, we believe that there have been, I love this line, some accounting irregularities and system deficiencies, whatever that means, in the accounting practices of Lazon, and certain incomes for certain quarters will have to be restated. After that filing, on December the 5th, 2001, Lazon filed for bankruptcy. And in February of 2003, my clients filed this action. After the 12B6 motion was filed, then it was converted to a summary judgment motion, and the contention of Pricewaterhouse is that my clients were on inquiry notice and that something had occurred. They don't allege just the Bassman email. They actually allege, I believe, that shifting the income post-acquisition was when they should have been on inquiry notice. But after briefing the issue before Judge Cooch, Judge Cooch found that Bassman email dated January the 6th, 1999, should have put my clients on inquiry notice, and they should have commenced this lawsuit within 3 years of that date by commencing in February 2003. It's time barred. The trial court relied very heavily on this court's decision in Becker versus Canada. And I just don't think that the two cases are the same. As your honors know, the facts in Becker versus Hamada, a guy put a roof on, I think it was an industrial roof, in 1971. And immediately after putting a roof on, every time it rained, it started to leak. And he would get people to come out and repair the roof at great expense. People come out 1972, 73, 74. I mean, you know, after a rain, it would drip. Ceiling tiles became discolored. I mean, so it wasn't until 1979 that the owner of this property retained an expert who came out, looked at the roof, and said, guess what? You got a bad roof in 1971. So Becker filed a lawsuit against the roof installer, and this court upheld the lower court's ruling that, hey, seeing all those recurrent leaks should have put Mr. Becker on notice that he had a cause of action that he should have filed earlier. In this case, we don't have any drips, no colored ceiling tiles. All we have is a request to book certain income post-acquisition, and we have the Bassman email. No continuing drips, nothing other than would put somebody on inquiry notice. But as I argued to the trial court, but we did investigate. My clients, as soon as they got the email, picked up the phone, called Monroe, said, we want answers. And Monroe came back the next day with answers. In hindsight, it's a stonewalled answer, but it was an answer. It wasn't like my clients put on tall, pointy hats, sat in their offices, and with glee made these accounting entries and said, no, they didn't sit on their hands. They raised questions. They saw a flag, and they did something that the law requires them to do. Investigate. They investigated. They investigated all the way through, you know, flying to Michigan, seeing outside board members, seeing the CF and seeing the chairman of the board. They investigated. But their investigation never revealed the fact that Pricewaterhouse had not been picking up the fraud that its client, Lazon, had been committing with respect to the accounting practices of that business. Now, I argued that Justice Jacobs' decision in Technicorp should be controlling, because in Technicorp, Your Honor held that if a potential victim does investigate and that investigation is met with stonewalling, that the statute of limitations will be told and inquiry notice will not be deemed to have been given.
Is it your contention that this is a factual matter that the jury should be deciding?
Well, I Justice Berger, I do, because I think Judge Cooch makes some miraculous findings. He makes a finding that my client should have picked up the phone and called Pricewaterhouse. I mean, my client has been in this, has just been in quiet for 40 days. Pick up the phone and call Pricewaterhouse. I just think that if you're expecting too much of somebody in my client's position after only 40 days of being acquired. I mean, in this world of Enron and WorldCom, perhaps, but back in 1998, you know, my client's just, they're 40 days into this business. What I argued to the trial court, and just Judge Cooch would not buy that argument, was I think that the Delaware ought to take a look at the same test that's being used by some of the federal courts, and the one I'm asking the court to look at is the one in Great Rivers Co-op, and it's cited in my brief. And where Great Rivers Co-op is important is you have to, it's a three-pronged test. What facts were available to the potential victim? Would a reasonable person with knowledge of those facts investigate? And the third prong is, after the victim, the potential victim, does his investigation, would that investigation reveal the potential claim? I think that's the fair way to look at it if you're going to apply inquiry notice, because if your investigation could never reveal the claim, how could you be deemed to be on inquiry notice? And the argument I made to Judge Cooch was, again, my client's a little cog in the spoke of this big wheel. We don't have all the books and records that Pricewaterhouse has access to. We don't have all the financial information of Lazon. All we have is our little piece of the puzzle.
Excuse me, Mr. Gibson. You're using your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to do.
If there are no other questions, then I'll sit down.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I am Marty Prochetz, and I represent PricewaterhouseCoopers. Since this is a motion for summary judgment that is up before this Court on appeal, I thought at the outset it would probably be useful to set forth some undisputed facts, and I don't think any of these are disputed in the brief that Mr. Gibson submitted or in his oral argument today. It is undisputed that the plaintiffs arranged for their company to purposely refrain from recording $500,000 of net income that had been earned prior to the acquisition of their company, which is DIT, by Lazon, and to record it instead as though that income had been earned after the acquisition. Mr. Gibson said today that those instructions were delivered to him, that is to his client, at the closing to defer that income. In fact, what the record reflects is that those instructions were delivered to Mr. Coleman 8 weeks prior to the closing, and that's at the appendix pages 118 to 119 in Mr. Coleman's testimony. Present, according to Mr. Lydon's testimony, at the time that those instructions were delivered, or it may also have been Mr. Coleman's testimony, were other shareholders from DIT, who are plaintiffs in this case. It's undisputed that they did the same thing, that is, take pre-acquisition income and defer it as though it had been earned in the post-acquisition period with regard to another $800,000 in revenue. And this is the revenue attributable to the pre-acquisition forgiveness of a debt that DIT had owned. It's undisputed that this was done with knowledge that this was a violation of generally accepted accounting principles. This wasn't just, as Mr. Gibson articulated earlier, aggressive accounting. For example, the email itself reflects the fact that under GAAP, this was not the correct treatment. And it's in that context that Mr. Bassman of Lazon instructs the plaintiffs, do it anyway because I'm taking an aggressive approach. But in the preceding sentence in the email, which Your Honors have before them, he specifically says that proper treatment under GAAP would require this to be a reduction in the purchase price under purchase accounting for the acquisition. There is no principle under GAAP pursuant to which you pretend that pre-acquisition income is post-acquisition income. Mr. Lydon himself, who is the chief financial officer of DIT, testified, it's in the record before this court, that he specifically understood that there was no justification in GAAP for this. Mr. Coleman testified that he was troubled by the request. The Bassman email, in addition to specifically saying that this is not the treatment under GAAP that would be appropriate, tells them to hide it from the auditors, which I think not only says something about issues that put the plaintiffs on inquiry notice that are inherent in that statement, but also goes to the question of whether they understood that there was something wrong with this accounting entry under GAAP.
Okay, but as I understand the facts, they get this email, they find it disturbing, they don't just sit back. They are put on some level of inquiry notice, and they make inquiry, and they're told by a much higher up than the person who sent that email that I've looked into it, that's the CEO, I've looked into it, and don't worry, everything's going to be fine, and it's going to be appropriately accounted for. Doesn't that kind of put them back in a posture of being able to say, okay, I no longer had a reason to believe that something was wrong here because I saw something suspicious, I checked with a higher-up, I got a satisfactory answer?
No, Your Honor, not in the slightest. There's a couple of factual reasons for that, and there are a couple of legal reasons for that. One factual thing that I'd like to point out is the case is not just about the $800,000. It's also about the $500,000 that I alluded to. Mr. Monroe, the person of whom the plaintiffs claim to have made the inquiry that Your Honor just asked about, specifically, according to Mr. Coleman's own testimony, instructed him to pretend that the $500,000 pre-acquisition revenue was in fact post-acquisition. Second of all, with regard to the legal considerations that apply to Your Honor's question, the law is that it is not enough to simply go to the alleged wrongdoer and ask him if everything is okay, and the alleged wrongdoer says, yes, everything is okay. If that were a diligent inquiry, and if that were enough to toll the running of the statute of limitations, we wouldn't have the principle of inquiry notice and the responsibility of conducting a diligent inquiry. In addition to that...
Well, aren't you putting the rabbit in the hat when you say that as a legal matter for the CEO of the acquiree to go to the top person at the acquirer and be told that there was no problem, he would take care of it, is not enough legally? Isn't that the issue here? The legal duty was?
I guess the issue, first of all, Your Honor, as I was about to say, the issue is, in fact, not whether they conducted some investigation. The issue is
whether their investigation was reasonable once they were put on inquiry notice.
Actually, I don't even think that's the issue, Your Honor.
It isn't.
No, I don't believe so. Not under the law that this court has articulated in other cases and that the various courts of the state have articulated. The law here is, first of all, there's the general principle. We start with the general principle that the ignorance is not an excuse, and the statute of limitations begins to run at the time that the injury is incurred.
Let's not get too convoluted. I thought your argument was that whatever it was that the acquirer did was not reasonable. That is, even though they were on inquiry notice of something, the inquiry they made wasn't reasonable. Your response was, well, that's not even the criterion. My question then is, what was the criterion? What is the test? Answer that question.
Yes, Your Honor. The issue is, are they any longer blamelessly ignorant, or is the existence of their claim inherently unknowable? That's what this court held in Becker versus Hamada. And the question is an objective question. The question is, are they on notice of facts sufficient to put them on inquiry so that an investigation would put a person of ordinary intelligence and prudence on actual notice of the existence of the claim? The fact that they made a telephone call to Mr. Monroe says nothing about that principle.
The law you know, once the acquirer, I'm sorry, the acquired company, the CEO, and his company is under some sort of some level of inquiry notice, the law has to tell them what their duty is in terms of the kind of inquiry that need to be made. Would you agree with that?
I don't think that it's an issue of the law telling them what kind of a inquiry to make.
They don't need to know or to be advised by someone who's knowledgeable in the law as to what they ought to be doing.
I think the question is, and as I mentioned, an objective one. In other words, if Mr. Monroe had said to them, "You're right, this is wrong, this is a fraud, and it shouldn't be done, and we've done it in other instances, and so the financial statements that you relied on were inherently fraudulent," you know, then clearly we would know that they were on actual notice. But the question here is, are these facts sufficient so that they are no longer blamelessly ignorant, so that now it is not inherently unknowable? And yes, Your Honor, I certainly agree that part of our argument is that this particular inquiry of simply calling Mr. Monroe, the man who told them to defer $500,000 in pre-acquisition revenue to the post-acquisition period, and B, by saying to him, and if one looks at the facts in terms of making a determination as to whether this was a diligent inquiry, Mr. Monroe, we've been told to make a non-GAAP entry to defer $1.3 million from the pre-acquisition period to the post-acquisition, that's the $500,000 and the $800,000, and we've been told to hide it from the auditors. Is that okay? Mr. Monroe, who was part of giving them that instruction, who instructed them with regard to $500,000, says, it's okay, we'll take care of it with PwC. That is not enough to stop the clock.
Because?
For two reasons. A, because the law is that there is no tolling simply by virtue of the fact that you do conduct an inquiry. The question is, are you on sufficient notice so that an ordinarily intelligent and prudent person would, in fact, discover the existence of the claim?
Okay, well, that's all fine and good. But, you know, following your position through, if what was done was not enough under any standard, then the question becomes, what is it that the plaintiff should have done?
Well, certainly.
And by what standard do we measure that
right at
that point in time? Can you answer that?
Yes. Obviously, we contended below, Judge Cooch found, and we contend in this court, that they should have contacted PricewaterhouseCoopers.
And done what?
Told them we were asked to make an entry and to hide it from you.
Okay. And what does the record show would have transpired had that been done?
Oh, it doesn't, Your Honor, but respectfully, I don't believe that's my burden. In other words, that is the point of this objective test as to whether a person of ordinary intelligence and prudence would have found out the existence of the claim if, in fact,
not
an inquiry had been conducted.
You move for summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your burden is to show that the undisputed facts are sufficient as a matter of law to require the entry of judgment in your client's favor.
Certainly.
Don't those undisputed facts include some kind of roadmap as to what would have occurred so that a fact finder could conclude that the inquiry, the proper inquiry, whatever that might have been, would have led to a discovery of the facts and enabled the plaintiff to file a claim within the limitations period?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't believe that that can possibly be the burden, because in that instance...
The answer is no.
Yes, the answer is no.
So what the record does show is, A, that they didn't speak to Pricewaterhouse.
Yes.
Doesn't show what would have happened had they done so. What we have is basically a speculative possibility, that is, a fact scenario under which, had Pricewaterhouse been told of what the plaintiffs had learned, then they might have taken corrective action.
Well,
right?
Yes, that's true.
Okay. Your point is that that's enough.
Absolutely.
And it's up to the other side to negate that.
Yes. It is up to the... my point is this. First of all, in response to Your Honor's question, it's not possible for me or any other lawyer for a defendant moving for summary judgment in this context to tell you what would have happened if events that didn't happen had taken place. That's an impossible burden. I couldn't possibly do that, nor could any moving for summary judgment on statute of limitations grounds where inquiry notice rather than actual notice is the issue. And second of all, that relates to what the test is. The test is not, can I demonstrate what would have happened if things happened that didn't happen? The test is, were the plaintiffs any longer blamelessly ignorant, and was the claim inherently unknowable? If the answer to that question is no, that they were no longer blamelessly ignorant, and that it was not inherently unknowable, unless my client engaged in a fraud or acts of concealment, the statute of limitations is not told. That's the law in this state. And the fact of the matter is that in this case, it's a virtual concession that the statute of limitations was not told. When Mr. Gibson says in his brief, as he does at page 16, that there is no allegation in this case that PwC engaged in any fraud whatsoever, or that PwC concealed any facts from the plaintiffs whatsoever. He goes to great lengths to say it was Lazon that committed the fraud, Lazon that stole Walder's clients, Lazon that concealed, and his beef, so to speak, with PwC is that they didn't find it. They didn't find the conduct that Mr. Gibson's clients and others concealed from them. Under that set of facts, given what the law of fraudulent concealment is, and given, for example, the holding of the Superior Court in Ruger against Frank, which is that fraud or concealment by a third party does not toll the statute of limitations.
Okay, so they weren't blamelessly ignorant that Lazon may have been committing a fraud, correct?
That's correct.
But does it follow, as a matter of law, that they were also not blamelessly ignorant that there was accounting misfeasance, so to speak, accounting negligence on the part of the public accounting firm?
I don't think that's a question of whether they were blamelessly ignorant. I don't think it's a question of law, Your Honor. I think that's a question of fact. And I think here it's undisputed that they were not blamelessly ignorant. They were told to make a non-GAAP entry. They testified that they understood that it was non-GAAP. They were told to hide it from the auditors. They testified that they hid it from the auditors.
I'm not sure you heard my question.
Perhaps not.
I will concede, at least for this purpose, that those facts would render the plaintiffs not blamelessly ignorant that Lazon, Pricewaterhouse's client, was doing something untoward.
Your Honor. I apologize.
But we're talking about whether or not, as a matter of law, the same plaintiffs were not blamelessly ignorant, that there might have been some professional malpractice, negligence, yes, on the part of the accounting firm.
Yes.
That's a different question.
But here's the question, Your Honor. They were told to make this entry. They were told to hide it from the auditors. They did hide it from the auditors. If that's not being... it's a double negative. If that doesn't demonstrate that they are no longer blamelessly ignorant of the fact that PwC is unaware, or at least the possibility that PwC is unaware that this manner of accounting has been occurring and that income of Lazon has been inflated as a result of it, then I'm not sure what is.
Possibility.
Oh, sure. But that's inquiry notice, Your Honor. They don't have to know it for a fact. Otherwise, we'd be talking about actual notice.
Isn't what we have here an issue of fact as to whether or not the plaintiffs were blamelessly ignorant of the possibility, or I should say, blamelessly ignorant that there might be a claim against Pricewaterhouse?
No. Clearly, our contention is to the contrary, given this, Gibson referred to the Becker case involving drips. This is Gusher. This isn't just drips. This is people, his clients, who purposely made entries that they purposely hid from the auditors. The testimony is that they put it into accounts that have nothing to do with this revenue so that the auditors wouldn't find it. Now, they understood that it wasn't generally accepted accounting principles. They understood that they were hiding it from the auditors. If that doesn't constitute inquiry notice, A, of the existence of the fraud, and B, to go to Your Honor's question of the possibility, which is all we're talking about on inquiry notice, that PwC was ignorant of the fraud, then I'm not sure what would be. They're specifically engaged in conduct that they know inflates Lazon's income. As a matter of fact, Mr. Gibson himself, in a companion case, and this is in the record and relied upon in part by Judge Cooch, specifically cited the Coleman example as one in which, as a result of the conduct of these plaintiffs, the income of Lazon was artificially increased, he said by $1.5 million. I think it's $1.3 million, but obviously that difference is immaterial for these purposes. And under those circumstances where you are hiding that from the auditors, and the very nature of your claim is, because this is a negligence case, negligent misrepresentation, you, the auditors, failed to find this. You are clearly not blamelessly ignorant of the notion that they failed to find it. It's either you, the auditors, failed to find it, and therefore you didn't do anything about it, or it would be you, the auditors, knew about it and didn't do anything about it, in which case, obviously, we're talking about a fraud claim, which doesn't exist here. So it really is a question of, are they any longer blamelessly ignorant? Is it now inherently unknowable that the auditors don't know that this accounting is occurring when, A, they're doing it, and B, they're told to hide it from the auditors, and C, they do hide it from the auditors? I think that directly answers Your Honor's question, and I think that directly goes to the issue of whether there is any genuine issue of material fact for trial as to whether, indeed, they were on notice at that point. And that's why we moved for summary judgment. I see I'm out of time, so unless there are additional questions, I've completed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. In response to some of your questions, Justice Jacobs, I'm reminded of the movie American Beauty Rose with the dysfunctional marriage of Kevin Spacey and Annette Bening, where Kevin Spacey kills himself and Annette Bening, who's been having all these extramarital affairs, runs through the house screaming, "I'm the victim, I'm the victim." Well, Pricewaterhouse has been running through this litigation saying, "I'm the victim, I'm the victim," when they were the gatekeeper. Now, I sat there and I reminded myself I'm not supposed to exhibit any behavior that I can't control myself. But for Mr. Pichette to stand up here and say my clients hid something from the auditors is just not the facts of this case. There's nothing. My client said they called Monroe. Monroe said, book it the way Bassman told you to do it, and Bassman will work it out with PwC. My clients didn't hide anything from the auditors. They went away from that conversation under the impression that they were going to book it as requested and that the internal accounting department at Lazon would work it out with PwC. My client has no access to see how they did that or whether they did that or not. So they didn't hide anything intentionally from the auditors. In the Technicorp case, Justice Jacobs, you actually, the facts in that case was the potential victim retained an accounting firm to look into the potential claim, and that accounting firm made one report saying the balance sheets aren't consistent, and then the victim retained that accounting firm to go back in, and the accounting firm came out and said, we see there might be potential fraud with the way Technicorp's been doing its books. And still, Your Honor didn't see inquiry notices running under those circumstances. You found inquiry came after the victim actually acquired control of the company and had access to all the books and records. Had my client had access to all of Lazon's books and records, we would have known that, okay, they're doing it with my client. What about the other 75 acquired companies? I mean, that was fraud on a very broad basis that the accounting firm should have picked up. My client said, we keep putting tall, pointy hats on my clients. My clients actually said they kept that Bassman email right there on site. They didn't throw it away. They didn't shred it. If PwC had come, which they probably should have, and looked at the books and records of my clients, they would have seen that Bassman email. They're the gatekeeper. They're not the victim. My clients are the victim. Thank you. Nothing further.
Thank you. The court appreciates the argument and will take a brief recess.
Please rise. Hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.